I am an alcoholic, and my name is Patricia. I apologize for keeping my jacket on. I'm still a little bit chilly. I'll probably take it off about halfway through. My sobriety date is July 4th, 2005. I am sponsored, and my sponsor is sponsored, and so on, as far up the line as I know. I am going to endeavor to share with you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I am like now, what brought me to AA, and why this hard head took such a long time to get it. I like to just read this, and any of you that are familiar with our basic text, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, will recognize this, but this describes to a T. There is not one false statement in here, what I was like when I came into these rooms, before I found the solution offered in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was having trouble with personal relationships. I couldn't control my emotional nature. I was prey to misery and depression. I could not make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear, bracket terror. I was unhappy, and I couldn't seem to be of any real use to anyone. Least of all, my family. I guess to start at the beginning, I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I am kind of on the top end of the middle of seven siblings. So I have five brothers, two sisters. And my mom had eight children in 8 years. And we are any modern psychologist or psychiatrist would call a dysfunctional family. We were growing up. I just thought it was fun. Now, there was a lot of chaos and confusion in my house because my father was the child of an alcoholic, as well as my mother. And he had a nasty temper, and it was very volatile, and you never really knew when it was going to go off. Now, there were some, like the Sunday bad mood, we called it, that was kind of predictable on those Sundays, those rare Sundays when it didn't happen. We all just went, whew, good Sunday. But generally, Sundays was a bad day, because I think, I was brought up Catholic, and I think my dad would sit in church and really start to feel the guilt, the weight of the guilt of his sins, and not feel good about himself afterwards. But that's just my opinion or my guess, or I have no idea of the validity of that. But I know I've suffered from that a lot. and I'm his daughter, so. I started drinking at around 15. But before I ever really took a drink, I mean, I had communion wine, and we, after First Communion, you got your little half glass of wine with dinner. But I never really, felt anything from that. I just felt grown up. But prior to really starting to drink, I always felt kind of invisible. I mean, I was in the middle of all these, sea of siblings, and I always kind of felt invisible. I felt like I didn't matter. I felt like an afterthought much of the time. My birthday was like 8 days before Christmas, and, my mom would call me up on the phone and say, "Can you make yourself a birthday cake?" So I didn't feel like I mattered. I was always daydreaming. I didn't have a whole lot of self-confidence. I think I was full of fear even then, although I wouldn't have been able to tell you that. And I always thought the grass was greener somewhere else. I always wanted to be somewhere else, with someone else, you know, at a different time. Often thought I was born at the wrong time. If I could have just been born in that century or on that continent. And I was a, you know, like I said, I was a constant daydreamer. And I very much had a Cinderella complex. I really wanted somebody to come riding in on their white horse and take me out of my misery. And I looked for that. And I looked hard and long for that. And I kept looking for that even when I knew that it was never going to happen. I just, you know, I really obstinate about, you know, I'm not going to be my own rescuer, you know. So, I mean, that's how I spent my childhood. Like I said, I thought it was fun and it was interesting and it was fairly chaotic. And, you know, other than the occasional, but pretty regular beatings, my childhood was fairly non-eventful. I started drinking. We moved, like, I don't know. I started drinking, like, right in junior high school. I kind of segued into drinking via a green leafy substance that is an outside issue, but that was my first, hey, you know, this is different than feeling the way I feel, so this is pretty neat. I had a couple of girlfriends that lived in the neighborhood, and who both later showed up in the rooms also. And they always had beer at their house. And so after school, we'd indulge in this substance and drink some Budweisers and cruise around in the T-Bird and just like the song. Didn't have much consequence to any of that. My parents didn't keep real close tabs on us because there was too many of us to keep real close tabs on. My girlfriend's parents didn't either. Her mom was drunk most of the time, and her father was never home. You know, we pretty much had free rein to do whatever we wanted to do. And if we wanted to sneak out, well, we snuck out. And, you know, I got very good at things like not getting caught. School wasn't very hard for me. I did well in the classes that I had some kind of interest in. If I didn't have an interest, then I did okay. But I didn't ever really try very hard. Needless to say, I liked German, so I got straight A's in German, but I didn't much like government, so I got a C in that. But and that's pretty much how my school career went. I learned how to take tests. That was my big accomplishment. I'd take the first one, you know, see what kind of grade I got, see how they, you know, what kind of tests they administered, and then I would study accordingly. But most of my studying was like, you know, cram and then brain dump it right afterwards. And I did a lot of that. So I know I, my first experience with alcohol being a solution for what ailed me came, I was about 15, and both of my girlfriends were a year younger than I was, and they both had older sisters, and I had a sister that was like, they were a year older than I was, and I had a sister who was a year older. And I was spending the night at my girlfriend's house, and she wanted to go to bed, and it was like around midnight, and she was like ready to go, you know, call it a day, and her sister came in and said, hey, you want to have a bottle of wine with me? You want to share a bottle of wine with me? And my girlfriend passed, and I said, well, hell yeah, you know, and I thought, well, you know, I have arrived, you know, the older sister is asking me, you know, asking to share my company, and I really felt the big shot, and we went down to Dad's wine cellar and picked out a nice bottle of wine, and our dads did not drink shabby wine. That was kind of a boon for me later on because I couldn't stand to drink the cheap stuff. And we shared a bottle of wine and we shared another one, and, you know, and we were just, you know, heart to heart sharing and just talking for hours, and I really felt like I had bonded with her and connected. It's like, you know, I found a soulmate, you know, she understands me. And of course next day that all evaporated, but you know, at the time it was just like, there's nothing better than this, you know. And I really felt like I fit in. I felt like I, you know, all my insecurity was gone. I just, you know, and I just realized that I liked this thing called alcohol. And from that point on, I pretty much drank whenever I could get it. And through high school, it was, you know, the 4 or 5 beers after school, driving around in the T-Bird, but it was mostly on weekends at the keg parties that, you know, people drove around. Where's the party? And, you know, I was in high school in the 70s, so, you know, there was always the big keggers going on. And, you know, they did get busted pretty regularly, but underage drinking was tolerated a lot more than it is today. Went off to college. You know, I remember running that thing by my parents. You know, I don't know what I want to be. I want to find myself. No, you're going to. I'm like, well, okay. It'll get me out of the house. Because I really, you know, at that point it was getting to be, it was getting hard to live there and hard to live with my father. So, yeah, by all means, okay, I'll go to school, I'll get out of the house. And I really believe for this alcoholic, that's where I crossed the line. I became a daily drinker. My paramount thought every day was, how am I going to manage to drink tonight? Or this afternoon, or whatever the case may be. If I had money, I didn't think about it too much. But if I didn't have money, which was mostly the case, I was obsessing about it. So maybe I could go call this guy up or call this girl up and see if she wants to go to the sea shop and share a few pictures. And, you know, once I got there, it was pretty much fine. But just getting the way in, you know. And that became of paramount importance. Basically, you know, I didn't lie when I told my parents I have no idea what I want to do, because I didn't. Even when I was in school, like, okay, well, I'm good at German, I'll major in German. Didn't know what I was going to do with it. But, you know, on paper, I majored in German. In reality, I majored in partying. And I did. And, you know, drugs are definitely a part of my story, but drinking was tantamount. I blacked out a lot more frequently, found myself in places that I didn't want to be in, but still the consequences were not too severe. I never scheduled classes before 11, because I knew I wouldn't go. In my senior year, I think I had to schedule a 9:30 class, and I hit it maybe 50% of the time, and that was doing pretty good. So, I graduated, not the best grades, but not the worst, and I graduated in 4 years, which was, I had spent my junior year overseas, and half of my credits didn't transfer, and I learned I did pretty well under pressure, because I think I, like, took 22 credits in my last semester. But, so I graduated. My parents weren't going to pay for an extra year if I needed it, so I got graduated, and that's when my drinking really took off. I swore I'd never drink and drive. Well, incidentally, I swore I'd never smoke, and I started smoking to cover up that other smell from that other green leafy substance. I swore I'd never drink and drive, and then I got a car. And I ended up getting a DUI, in 1983. I was probably about 24. It was the end of 1983, I think November. They sent me to ASAP up in Fairfax County. They called them DUIs back then. DWIs, driving while intoxicated. And I got a second one while I was in the ASAP class for the first one. And they asked me if I thought I might have a problem with drinking, and I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I was, like, really proud of myself for that admission. I had no idea what it was to be an alcoholic. I really had no idea what an alcoholic really was. To me, in my mind, I knew that an alcoholic didn't have to be some skid row drunk under a bridge, because I had been told my grandfather was an alcoholic. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholic, and they seemed normal enough to me. I thought an alcoholic was just somebody who drank too much. And I like to drink, so I thought, I'm an alcoholic. And I used that as an excuse to drink for a very long time. I did, after I lost the driver's license for a year, I did actually start going to AA because I was mandated to. They did the intake interview, and they breathalyzed me when I went in at dark 30 in the morning, and I had alcohol in my breath. So they said, well, I think you need to go to FACTS, which was Fairfax Alcohol Counseling and Treatment. And they mandated that I go to AA. At that point, I went to one meeting, and we would gather, we would meet as a group once a week, and I would just, make up topics and say, we talked about this, and write that down on my piece of paper and hand it in. So I went to one meeting and figured out, well, I can do this. And, but I started to get really tired. At that point, I was trying to not drink. And it was exceedingly difficult for me. I think I could, sometimes manage a week, sometimes 2 weeks. And I started really, really feeling bad about it. That I knew it was a problem. And so I started going to these AA meetings in earnest. I went to a beginner's meeting in Falls Church that they called a white chip meeting. And tell you how far out there I was. It was 2 months, 2 or 3 months before I realized they were not saying ship. They were saying chip. Because I never picked one up. And I couldn't ever figure out what a white ship, had to do with And I would go and I would listen to these stories, and it would make me thirsty, and I would go out and I would drink afterward. And after about a year of that, I found a women's meeting in McLean, and I remember hearing somebody say, just don't drink today. You can plan a keg party tomorrow. Don't do it today. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense to me. And I managed to get a 30-day chip. And that 30-day chip turned into 3.5 years, during which time I was sober and very much unrecovered. But I really thought I was something. I mean, when a few people shared to me what it was like to live with me at that time, I was like, I was shocked. I'm not today, because I know why, but at the time I was. I had a sponsor. I had a little home group. I had, I was chip chairman in my home group. Appropriate. And but she wasn't sponsored through the book. When I did my fourth step with her, it was a sin dump. I remember reading that part about, we feel like a weight has been lifted. I read that part in the book, and I looked at the part where it has the three columns, and I'm like, I don't see how that applies. So I basically just wrote down everything I think I did wrong in my whole life and laid it at this, on the table with this woman while she was deathly sick with the flu, and did not feel like I had been relieved of a heavy burden afterwards. I felt like I shocked her, and she probably didn't want to talk to me again. That was my, you know, my first attempt at trying to work the steps. It was off the wall, and my sobriety was off the wall. And in that time, I met somebody that I had known in high school, and I was like 28 years old and fretting of ever getting married because I was working in a beauty salon and all the guys I knew were gay and hanging out. And I was really in love with the idea of getting married and moving away from my parents' house because I was back there yet. So I got married. I thought that would solve all my problems. And I did, and I moved to Massachusetts and stayed sober up there, too. My meetings dwindled. I got a sponsor who basically used me as a counselor. And I'm like, gosh, why do I feel so bad when I get off the phone with her? So I stopped calling my sponsor. So I had a sponsor in name. I had a home group in name. I actually did have a home group, and I was treasurer of that home group, and I did pilfer money out of the treasury that I paid back eventually, but I never told him I was doing it. I mean, it just wasn't good stuff. My husband got sent to flight school, and I moved back in with my parents while he was doing that. I had a two-week-old baby girl, brothers in the house, and he's drinking constantly, and within a month, I was drinking again. That pretty much started about a six-year period of trying to stop, and then giving up, and then just drinking. My drinking looked a whole lot different after I got married. I drank at home. I drank Chardonnay by the case. I kept trying to stop. I would hit meetings, and then I would stop going, and just nothing seemed to work for me. And I was really unhappy and didn't know it. I mean, I knew that our marriage was rocky, and he kept saying, "You're the alcoholic. You just get better, and everything will be fine." Now, what I didn't know is because I was still sick when I met and married this man, that I married somebody that was as sick as I was, and he was an active drug addict, and I didn't know it. So he had a lot of good reason to point the finger elsewhere. But I believed it, and so I was really unhappy, and I spent, from then on, just about the rest of my life, up until very recently, in counseling of some form or another. Because I really thought that I was, like a lot of people say, you know, mentally defective and fatally flawed. I really believed that about myself. There's just something wrong with me. And I wanted to fix it, you know. And I kept looking for answers to fix what was wrong with me. And the only relief I ever got from that was an alcohol. And I looked for it in other drugs. I looked for it in people. I looked for it in religions. I looked for it in self-help books. I mean, I looked for it everywhere. Nothing could quiet that chaos and that negativity and that just that noise in my mind that says you're broken, you're defective. You know, and so being a fearful person from the get-go, just like the alcoholism, all that progresses over the years, and my fear turned into abject terror by the time I had gotten in here. I not only was afraid of everything and terrified of everything, but I hated everyone and everybody, including God, when I got here. I hated AA because I was convinced it wasn't going to work. I had had sponsors take me through the steps, had not done this the way my current sponsor had, and You know, that part in the fourth step where, you know, you've done your first three columns, you've listed who you're mad at, and the institutions you're mad at, and why, and, you know, I never got to that part in the book where it says, this is as far as most of us got, and we stayed sore. And I didn't know why, you know, these resentments weren't leaving me, why my life wasn't getting any better. So my husband ended up getting arrested due to his stuff. On our fifth wedding anniversary, I was visiting my folks, and I get a call from him from Fort Knox lockup, and I'm just like, my world's like turned upside down. By this time, I had two very young children, and just, you know, I was like walking around like, pinch me, I'm going to wake up from this nightmare sometime, any minute. But it didn't get better. He got convicted, and he got sent to courts-martial, got sent to Fort Leavenworth, and stayed there for quite some time, and that was pretty much the end of our marriage, although we're still married today on paper. Something that, that's one of those things that loose ends I have to tie up, but it's just something I keep forgetting about it because I have a hard time thinking of myself as married anymore. So I moved in with his mother-in-law, who, like myself, was crazier than a outhouse rat. She was nuts, and she didn't have the alcohol to blame it on. I tell you, that was, you talk about toxic. I mean, her and I on each other, with each other, oh, it was horrible. You know, and, you know, that just started just, you know, about 8 long years of serious insanity on both our parts. I had I don't know where I should go from here. To make a long story short, in searching for solutions with this, you know, I was in and out of AA. I thought I have somebody had introduced me to Dilaudids, and I got hooked on those for about a year and a half. By the time I quit that, I was shooting about 50 pills a day. Somebody had introduced me to crack, and I hit that 24/7 for about 8 months. My mother had died at that time, and she left me a large sum of money, so that's where it went. I mean, $64,000. You know, a few short months, and my insanity increased. And then, you know, I put myself back in a detox, and that's when another solution presented itself: psychotropic medication. And so I got hooked up with the psychiatric community, and stayed sober on the medications for maybe about 10 months. Started drinking again. Now I'm drinking on the medication. Getting more and more insane. Because they tell you don't drink on that stuff. And, you know, I believe it or not, especially the Wellbutrin, and I was taking, I think, what is it? Valproic acid is the generic for I think Depakote. I could feel my brain buzz like it was like there was electric current going through it when I drank on that stuff, and yet I continued to do it. And I knew, you know, and I'm drinking basically because I want to quiet my mind, and I'm drinking to the point where I can pass out, and then I'm taking Restoril and Trazodone right before I lay down, go to sleep. And I, you know, that I lived through that is amazing to me today, because I could have overdone it so easily, because I did not have any checks and balances on how much I was drinking. I had a nice gallon of rum right there, and I drank until it was like, you know, okay, the room started to spin, time to take my pills and lie down. and my world, you know, fortunately, I didn't see it that way at the time, but I had lost custody of my children. So my sister-in-law was taking care of my children, and they didn't have to live through that. But I tried to see my children on a regular basis, and the time that I could spend with them by the time I was done was probably about 40 minutes before that, you know, overwhelming need to take a drink would kick in. And then I'd have to drive them home and start drinking on the way home because I wasn't going to drink when I was around them. My life got to be about the size of a postage stamp. I had my room. I had my TV. I had my cigarettes, my ashtray, and my bathroom in case I needed that. And it was a horrible, horrible existence. And I could not live with myself sober. And but at this point, I could not physically stand to be sober. My body craved it so bad, and it was starting to shut down. My pancreas was starting to shut down. I was starting to lose my hair. I was shaking really, really bad. And I'm doing all of this while I'm taking these medications. And I ended up I ended up doing something to my mother-in-law that I should have been arrested for, and I was asked to leave, and I ended up homeless after being in a psych ward again. My drinking took me to psych ward so many times, I can't count how many. I've been to detoxes. I've been to outpatient treatment at least a half dozen times, inpatient treatment about three times. I've been TDO to Central State for fighting a med tech, which I didn't remember doing, and waking up there in restraints and not knowing I was there. I've OD'd like three times. If there hadn't been somebody around, I would have been dead. When they tell you this takes you to jails, institutions, and death, they're not lying. I've spent all told probably about a year in jail. The longest stretch was about 8 months where they sentenced me to a program. and, you know, I got a lot of education in alcohol, on alcoholism. I had counselors tell me that I could be teaching the classes, that I had amassed that much knowledge. And yet that knowledge couldn't keep me sober. But I believed a lot of what the treatment community was telling me, that all I had to do was change my people, places, and playgrounds, that I had to think the drink through. You know, I believed what some people were telling me in meetings, you drink because you want to. I had a sponsor who kept telling me there's some aspect of oblivion that still appeals to you. And I believed a lot of misinformation. Could you imagine how relieved I was when my sponsor sat me down and says, you drink because you're an alcoholic. You know, that's what we do. I'm like, oh, you know, and then, you know, I met this woman and she started taking me through this book and I learned really what it was to be an alcoholic. I not only have this allergy that when I put a drink in my body, I have no control over how much I will take after that. But I have the kind of mind that can't stay away from that drink. I mean, they tell us in this book that it would be academic if we never took the first drink, which means, you know, having the allergy of the body would be of no consequence whatsoever if we didn't take the first drink. But we keep taking the first drink. And I couldn't understand why I kept taking that first drink, even when I knew where it would lead me. You know, and I still had a hard time believing that part that says we have no power over, our mind has no power over whether or not we'll take that drink. Because I had had some sobriety, some, you know, I'll go to the rooms, I'll go to the meetings, I'll put the plug in the jug, I'll take it one day at a time, and I'll stay sober, and I don't need those steps. I had had some experience with that, and I had suffered from the delusion that I had power over whether or not I took the drink. I knew I did not have the power of what happened when I took the drink, but I really thought I had the power not to take the drink. But it became crystal clear to me when, on three occasions, and they were very close to each other, where I took that drink, arguing with myself the whole time. I mean, it had stopped being my solution. All it did was magnify my misery. It did not quiet the mind anymore, you know, unless I drank enough to pass out. But it did not give me any relief, and it just, you know, made my problems, you know, huge. And I drank anyway. And I didn't want to. And, you know, it's like, okay, you know, now I know I'm not drinking because I want to. I'm drinking because I'm an alcoholic. And I finally really believed wholeheartedly that truth, that I have the kind of mind that will not let me stay away from that drink. That the only way I was going to stay away from that drink is if you put me 6 foot under or put me in a cage. Lock me up. And I got to that point of desperation where I was really willing to do what they were asking me to do in this book. And between that discovery, I had, with the consent of my psychiatrist, weaned myself off of my psychotropic medications, because my sponsor presented me with the idea that perhaps what I was suffering from, or a lot of what I was suffering from, was untreated alcoholism, and that intrigued me. So I had weaned myself on all but one of those medications, and that was like one problem that I was not willing to relinquish. You know, that was not my alcoholism, that was my insomnia, so I'm going to take my Restoril. It is a benzo. Some people refer to it as chewy booze. But she kept telling me I was taking it for effect. And I kept arguing with her and saying, no, I am not. I'm taking it as directed. I don't get high on it. I just take it to help me sleep. And, you know, after about the third time I drank, she says, how's that working for you? And I says, well, I guess it's not. So I gave that up as well. And, you know, on the other side of it, I realized that I was taking it for effect. I was taking it to quiet my mind, which is the same reason I drank, to quiet my mind, so that I could get some peace, so that I could get some sleep. And that's exactly why I drank, to quiet. And that's what it was. I mean, people, when I first started coming to Jaywalkers, people were scared of me. I mean, I was insane. I really was nuts. I was lunatic. And, you know, people would... And, you know, I didn't really believe that at first, but I've seen others come in after me that are in similar conditions, and I'm like, I believe it now. And now I think back, you know, with a clearer mind and how I was like. And, you know, no wonder they diagnosed me as bipolar, because, you know, I could get manic enough, you know, in a heartbeat, you know. I'd be all calm and collected and flip the script, and the next minute I'm just, you know, my eyes are bugging out of my head and I'm running around, okay, especially when I got excited or agitated, one or the other, you know. Anyway, so my sponsor started taking me through this book, starting with the first page, and she pointed out to me that there were directions in this book. And I'm like, oh, she goes, where it says ask, where it says pray, where it says write, you know, just follow the directions. And if you don't understand something, ask. And we started going through this page by page, and she pointed out the little three-sided triangle with a circle around it, and says you need to be in all three parts. It's a, you know, threefold disease, mind, body, and spirit. And you need recovery in all three areas. So that meant, you know, it was more than just meetings. And I remember her telling me in a book study, it's like, you know, your sobriety is not for you. Your job is to outfit yourself to be of maximum service to you and my fellows. My job is to outfit myself to be of maximum use to you, the world and my, you know, my fellows and God. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, when do I get mine? You know? And that's how I looked at service for years. I will give back when I get. But I don't got it yet. You know, I used to be one of those people who sat in the back of the room, and when they read the promises out of these extravagant promises, yes, you betcha. Because they will never come true for me. She said, no, that's not the way it works. You have to start giving back to the world. I did not realize what a serious taker it was. I mean, I knew that I was emotionally dependent on other people. And I knew that that's why most of my relationships failed. I knew that from counseling. I sucked people dry. You know, it was like, I'm the victim, come rescue me. They'd rescue me, and I'd suck them dry, and then they'd end up, you know. They'd end up hurting me, and I'm the victim. So, you know, some of those books do make sense, because we do crazy crap like that. But it doesn't tell you how to stop it. That's what all my counseling did. It's like, oh, no wonder you are the way you are. You're such a survivor. Gosh, I don't see how you made it through all that. You know, no wonder you think the way you do. Okay, now, how do I fix it? Well, write some affirmations on the mirror. Believe me, I would not be here tonight if affirmations on the mirror worked. Tell yourself that you're good. Tell yourself you love yourself. I'm like, bullshit. You damn liar, you know. So I really started working these steps. I had started when I was still, you know, not willing to let go absolutely. I had started working these steps and kind of self-propelled myself up to about step 8. Looked at my list, said, I can't do this. And that was the absolute truth. I couldn't do it. But I had not asked God with me. And so when I went through this again, I went through it giving my life, conceding to my innermost self and letting go absolutely and giving my my will and my life over to the care of God and letting go of any idea of what that was supposed to look like. And if I ended up a nun in a convent in Tibet somewhere, then so be it, because it's got to be better than where I am. And needless to say, I'm not there. I tell you what, I used to think it was really ironic because, you know, my biggest fear was that I would end up, you know, in some some convent somewhere and celibate and in this whole process of getting sober, I lived in an old cloister, was celibate by choice, and so all those fears were just like, you didn't have to be afraid. I got through the fourth step. And this time, instead of getting all manicky every time I put my pen to the paper, I prayed before I went into it. I just turned the instructions into a prayer. Help me get rid of a damaged and unsaleable goods. Help me to see how a life based on self-will can hardly be a success. Help me to see where my fears and my selfishness is the root of all my troubles. And I did swallow some huge chunks of truth about myself. And I began to see that all those places where I thought I was such a victim that I had pretty much volunteered for every single bit of it. I had always made some decision, usually based on fear, self-centered fear, that placed me in a position to be hurt. Or I chose not to make the decision, and the decision was made for me, and I could yell victim once again. Look what they did to me. And so I got to see that about myself. And I got to share that with somebody else. And I got to see that I was not as defective as I thought I was. I was not as fatally flawed because there were people around me that I could see with lives that made sense, that walked this program and had peace of mind. And they were just like me. And they drank just like me. And they thought just like me. when I got to my eighth step again, I knew that these events were possible because I had, that God would make them possible. And they tell us, or I was told, that don't worry about doing step 9 when you're on step 4, because when you're on step 8, you'll be given the strength to do step 9. And that, I did find that to be my experience. I would like to say that I effectively do a step 10 a lot, but I don't. Generally, if it's something that I'm ashamed of, I usually don't discuss it with somebody else at once. But when it really starts to cause me significant discomfort, I will talk to someone else about it. I do try to, when I wrong somebody, to clean it up immediately. It's just easier for me to live that way. I do my 11-step with a prayer and meditation every morning. I wish I could remind myself to pause when agitated and doubtful a lot more than I do. And, you know, on practicing these principles in all my affairs, a lot of people say that the most difficult place that they find to practice this is at home. And I have to say that I concur, because my poor cats, when I get mad, because I forget that, you know, I'm thinking I'm alone, but then I'm not. They're there. And, you know, they hear me. And they fear when I raise my voice. You know, and I beat myself up and say I shouldn't be a cat owner. I don't deserve to be a town cat. And I talked about it with my sponsor, and she says, it's okay. It's okay. But, and I do, you know, I still drag my feet a lot when, you know, in carrying the message, and, you know, it's like, oh, gosh, I just don't want to go tonight. And that's precisely why I should go. My sponsor shared with me something very early on, which helped me through this whole process, is that how I feel is irrelevant. I just need to suit up and show up. Because how I feel will change at any given moment. But the actions that I take are what people judge me on, and not what I'm thinking up here. Thank God. And I tell you, I had this tape in my head. It's like my, you know, my head was a tape player, and I had this tape in there that it stuck for years. Continuous loop of negativity. It's what kept me up at night. Just, you know, glue, doom, negativity, and, you know, self-flagellation, just beating myself up, to, you know, like, you know, and it's like, even, you know, even early on when I was working the steps, it was like, you know, I'm just too sick to get it. I'm one of these people that is sicker than others, and I am too damaged. I am too broken. It will never work for me. It'll work for you, but it won't work for me, because I'm just, you know, I'm sicker than everybody else. And thankfully, that was not true. But I was convinced of it when I first got here. I thought I was one of those grave emotional and mental disorder things. And I lacked the capacity to be honest. I did lack a capacity to be honest with myself in the beginning. I suffered from a lot of delusion, but going through this fourth step really helped to clear a lot of that out. The second time I went through a fourth step, I really began to see how selfish and self-centered I really am. The first time I saw that I volunteered for most of my victimization, the second time I got to see how selfish I really was. You know, and I used to think, oh, you know, I want to be in a relationship. And now I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I think I'm a little bit too selfish to inflict that on somebody else. But it's okay, because, you know, today I'm really at peace with my own company. You know, I can enjoy my solitude to the point where some people think it might be unhealthy. But I've got commitments that keep me from going there. You know, I keep up. I suit up and I show up, even if I don't feel like it. You know, most of the time I don't It used to be most of the time I don't feel like doing the right thing. Today, it's just some of the time I don't feel like doing the right thing. But when I do the right thing, remarkable things happen. I am a really big fan of the page 100 in this book about, you know, if we put ourselves in God's hands, remarkable things will happen. The things that come to us are better than anything we could have planned. What has come to me, I mean, if you had told me 2 years ago, I'm on disability, I can't drive, I'm homeless, I don't have my family, I don't have custody of my kids, you know, all that's changed. You know, when I started going through this process, that was my circumstances. When I finished, when I got up to halfway through step 9, that was still my circumstances. But it wasn't, you know, I didn't see those circumstances as being a negative thing anymore. Because what was going on in here was 100% better. I realized, you know, for the first time in my life, I felt I had some use. And that I felt useful. And I felt that I had a reason for existing instead of just taking up somebody else's oxygen. And, you know, I could barely focus when I first got here. And, you know, just through a series of suiting up and showing up and doing the next thing I was supposed to be doing, you know, it's like I've got a career now. I'm a licensed professional insurance agent. And my criminal record is, that's not supposed to happen, you know. I could have said up until yesterday I caught a car that's legal. but I didn't drive it here, so I'm still legal. My window rolled down, so it flunked inspection. So it's the driver's window. It's the only one that has to work. For those toll booths, you know. That's your backup signal. Well, it is. That's the reason they give you. Anyway, I just cannot, I can't believe what has happened to me in such a short period of time. I mean, I'm sober a little over 2 years, but I have not had a psychotropic drug. And I have not had a drink in that time, you know. And I don't suffer for. I'm not prey to misery and depression. I used to be constantly depressed, you know, to the point pulled by covers over my head. I want to die. Can't do. Put my one foot in front of the other. Depressed. That doesn't happen to me anymore. Sure, I get the blues like everybody else. Sure, I get lonely like everybody else. But you know, I don't get that. Life is meaningless, and I'm just a piece of crap anymore. I continue to try to grow in understanding and effectiveness with my in my relationship with my higher power, and that's something that I struggle with, because there are some times when I just don't feel the nearness of my Creator, and I just have to go through the motions because I know that's what I'm supposed to do. And I get to the other side of that, and there's always some kind of blessing on it. There really is. I don't know what else to say except for I am really grateful that there was something inside me that did not give up on this program, and that you all did not give up on me, and that I have been able to find a personal relationship with the God of my understanding, because I was searching for that all my life and didn't know it. And with that, I think I'm done. So.